Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 2nd, 2012. When a bank executive says customers with less than $100,000 in deposits are, quote, unprofitable, why isn't there more outreach?
Stockholm syndrome, right? You've been a captive of the banks and their machinations for so long that you're like, oh, what next?
Apparently, we do not expect them to love us anymore. We do expect our president and first family to present a certain image, and that image can be costly to them.
There are very complicated rules governing who pays for what in the White House. The Obamas have to pay for a lot of stuff themselves, and the prices are at Ritz-Carlton levels.
At least they didn't have to buy their own light bulbs, because if they did...
Buying a light bulb has been one of those areas where you really didn't have to know much. It was sort of, you picked up a bulb and they were pretty much all the same.
CFL, LED, OMG, sorting the cost of luminescence. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Yes, this week JPMorgan Chase held an investor day, and its CEO Jamie Dimon was en fuego. The guy was on fire. He took pot shots at regulators, he took pot shots at reporters, and then the head of his consumer and banking business said what I just said earlier. So, hello, what exactly are we supposed to make of that, particularly in the era of the, 99% versus the 1%, that whole thing that went down last fall? Well, we decided to bring in my sister in high finance, New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Hello, sister of mine.
Hi, Tess.
Sisters, sisters, there were never such devoted sisters.
Oh, my dear, I think we're going to have to start a variety show.
Or braid each other's hair.
We could do that, too. I like that.
Yeah.
So, Jamie Dimon, his head of consumer banking, who comes out and basically says, if you don't have $100,000 or more, you're really not doing anything for us. Thanks.
I know. And then they don't want us to take it personally. Well,
of course
that's
not.
Pretty hard. Yeah. You know, us bank customers, we're so irrational. We just want to be romanced when all they want to do is give us checking. What's wrong with us? But what he was really saying is he was making a statement of fact about Chase, right? They have a lot of infrastructure. They have call centers. They have branches. All these things cost money. And most people, in fact, 70% of their customers who have less than $100,000 don't use those services in an efficient way, right? Mm. So they just don't make enough money for the bank to justify all of that. So what they want to do is move us into the new waiting line for the hoi polloi, which is mobile apps and internet banking, where we're not actually dealing with people who are expensive to provide. And they want more rich people in the actual branches.
Wow.
And to do that, they're going to build 900 more branches over the next 3 years. And some of these branches are going to have things like private rooms for rich people to do their checking. And they're the whole point of it.
Wow.
Presumably
I don't get a private room?
Gold.
Is that what you're telling me?
That's right. You have to stand out in the lobby and hope that...
long line.
In a very long line and, probably checking your smartphone.
Right.
Which you can
and with everyone
account.
Knowing that I'm not rich because I'm not in that special room.
Exactly. Which is probably plated with gold. I mean, we don't know what it's going to look like.
Dear.
But the idea of that is that, rich people have a lot of money to manage, right? So, it's that old joke about why did Willie Sutton rob the banks? Because that's where the money is.
Yeah.
Banks like to go to rich people because that's where the
that's
money
where
is.
That's where the money is. That's right.
Right. So they want to manage that money.
So my guess then is that, they are going to want to make money off us somehow. And mm-hmm. there was this big brouhaha over fees last fall. And, power to the people, folks basically got that taken off the docket. But, aren't we going to basically start seeing other kinds of fees?
Yeah, this is the flip side of the endless American knack for innovation, which is banks
right.
will have an unlimited font of how to charge us fees. So Wells Fargo, for instance, is, if you have less than 3 checking accounts or you don't have a mortgage with the bank, they're going to charge you $15.
Woo.
Just for your checking. Citibank customers are being charged $20 a month unless they have $15,000 just sitting around in their accounts.
Mm.
So a lot of these solutions are going to be very quiet, though. A lot of the banks don't want the same rebellion that Bank of America got when it talked about that $5 debit fee.
Well, and I guess, you know, at some point we do have to say, I mean, banks are providing a service. They are holding onto our money. Of course, they're making money off our money. But, you know, I mean, they have to charge us something, perhaps, because otherwise we could just put it on the under the mattress and then, you know, risk a house fire where we lose all our money, right?
Yeah, they need us, right? The way that banks work.
And we need them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we need our money to be protected. It's only 4 years after the financial crisis. On a large level, I talk to a lot of people who are just grateful. You know, they'll pay a few fees, not too many, and they'll deal with an arrogant tone as long as our banks are still solvent, you know, as long as we're insured. And the way that banks work is that they take our money and then they lend it out. You know, they don't keep it in a vault somewhere. So they need us to be able to do their business. The problem is that they need us to save more, to have more in that bank account. And as we know, a lot of people aren't saving. First of all, interest rates aren't rewarding. And second of all, a lot of people are paying off all that debt that they racked up in the early 2000s.
Well, and quite frankly, I mean, should we be worried about Chase? It's this huge bank. Is there a danger that they would then, if we're not depositing our money with them, take a loss and drag us all down again?
Well, if that happens in massive numbers, I mean, if we're talking about a real banking revolution, yeah, we could hurt the banking system. Right now, Chase looks rock solid. A lot of our big banks are doing well, and we shouldn't examine that too closely. But what we do know is that during the financial crisis, they didn't get in trouble for our checking accounts.
Right.
They got in trouble for what they were doing with derivatives, with you know, fancy financial instruments, and they still have those businesses. And if they haven't learned their lessons and they're not managing that risk, they could put us and themselves in trouble again. So we do have to keep them accountable and hope that our regulators and our Washington politicians do too.
Okay. Our New York Bureau Chief and, as I said, my sister in high finance, Heidi Moore. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
The pre-existing condition has been the bane of medical patients for years. You have some malady in your history that keeps you from getting insurance or denies you certain coverage. As of 2014, the healthcare reform law will prohibit all of those kinds of exclusions. Meantime, commentator Renee Lux shares her story of how a simple medical precaution led to a hike in her insurance costs.
Last May, I woke up with a stiff neck. By the end of the week, I couldn't move my head, so I saw my doctor. After a brief exam, he was sure of my diagnosis, but he scheduled me for a CT scan just to be certain. The scan confirmed what he thought. I had radiculitis cervicalgia, inflammation leading to a pinched nerve. I was prescribed prednisone, and in 10 days, the pain was gone. My total out-of-pocket expense was $55 in copays. But it turns out that CT scan will cost me an additional $2,220 a year in health insurance premiums. Stress and anxiety was the likely cause of my radiculitis. At the time, I was trying to find affordable health insurance. My husband had been out of work for over a year, and our COBRA coverage was about to run out. I contacted a health insurance broker looking for a high-deductible plan with no pre-existing conditions. My family of four is healthy, average weight, non-smoking, and no one was on medication. The broker found us a plan and sent over an application that I carefully filled out. Within hours of sending it back, I received a frantic phone call. "You said you had no pre-existing conditions," she yelled. The broker was adamant that the recent CT scan would trigger an automatic denial. I didn't believe her, so I contacted a new broker. When I told him about the CT scan, there was a long silence. He suggested we apply to three insurance companies at the same time. That way, if one company denied me, the other two wouldn't automatically disqualify me. I filled out three applications and did phone interviews with two underwriters. One company denied me coverage. Another company offered me coverage but refused to cover any future injury involving my spine. The final insurance company approved my coverage but with a premium increase to cover what it called my pre-existing condition, inflammation of the neck. Had I known the repercussions, I would have asked my doctor last May if that CT scan was absolutely necessary. The long-term effect of my pain in the neck is an additional $189 a month for the foreseeable future.
Renee Lux is a married mother of two living in Greenwich, Connecticut. This was her winning essay for a contest by a nonprofit organization called Cost of Care. The contest sought to raise awareness of what doctors and patients can do to curb healthcare costs. There once was a man from Nantucket who had to pay his taxes from a bucket or something like that. I don't know. Guess what? It is Marketplace Money Limerick time again. Loyal listeners will remember last summer we held a limerick contest with Dr. Goose, one of my Twitter pals, and you submitted your own poems about the debt ceiling debate. Wow, that seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? Well, in 2 weeks, in celebration of St. Patrick's Day weekend, we'll bring Dr. Goose back and hear your limericks about taxes. Submit them on our website or on Facebook. I don't think you can have a 140-character limerick, but feel free to try tweeting one to me at Radio Tess. Let the games begin. New efficiency standards for light bulbs could save you money on your energy bill, but they make no promises when it comes to your appearance.
We all still go into fitting rooms and bathrooms and other places where the lighting is not very flattering. And I think people feel that, you know, they're going to have to take that home with them now.
We will have an illuminating look at changes in the light bulb market. You may groan now. Plus, more from our wealth and poverty desk as we hear how Americans save money up and down the income spectrum.
I don't keep a strict budget, but always in the back of my mind is the thought that, okay, the mortgage is going to be this part, and it's been cold, so the electric bill is going to be a little higher, and the gas bill is going to be a little higher, so maybe I shouldn't spend as much.
That's later on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Art on the radio is never a simple proposition, but Carl Richards does it pretty darn well. You've heard him on the show before. We call him the Sharpie on a cocktail napkin guy. You also may have seen his drawings on the New York Times Bucks blog. Carl is a financial advisor. He's the director of education at BAM Advisor Services. And he has a new book out called The Behavior Gap, Simple Ways to Stop Doing Dumb Things with Money. Drawings from the book are on exhibit at the Kimball Arts Center in Park City, Utah. And last week, we conducted an interview about them in front of a live audience at the Kimball. We're airing a portion of that conversation today. I started by asking Carl why we have such a tough time talking about money.
I don't know. It's a problem, though. And I think that's like the baseline problem is I don't know if it was just the time we grew up in or if it's still the truth now, but money, sex, and politics were just things you didn't talk about in polite company. Now, we've taken it way too far on the politics side. We're all way too comfortable talking about politics.
Can we please stop talking about that for a minute?
But the money thing, still, we haven't. I don't know. Maybe we just don't have the framework. We sort of expect it to be a spreadsheet issue. It should be math, right? But what we don't understand is there's so much emotion wrapped up in these financial decisions that sometimes having the context for those discussions, right, still among the leading causes of divorce.
Yes.
I read somewhere that it was among the number one, it was the number one cause of adult male suicide in our country the last couple of years. So financial issues, not necessarily money itself, but financial issues.
Understandable over the last 2 or 3 years. But so all of which to say that I think the book is a really great starting place if you're not having that conversation. So hopefully we're going to perhaps start that discussion tonight. I told Carl that I wanted to start with the sketch that is actually on the cover of the book. And why don't you talk us through this? What are we looking at here?
This is sort of like, I don't know what to call that, some sort of curve, roller coaster, sine curve. That sounds too official, but a wavy line.
You mean like a S-I-N-E curve?
I don't even know what that word means. I just made it up. So this wavy line, you know, we often, that's sort of what the stock market looks like to us, you know? And we can track behavior of investors through money flows. Like, we know how much money goes into bond funds. We know how much money goes into safe funds and aggressive funds and growth funds. We know all that stuff. And what is amazing to me is we'd make the same mistake over and over and over. And the best example I know, the one I like to share the most, is 1999. If you remember in 99, we had this huge technology run, right? The market just went crazy for 2 or 3 years. If you imagine we're on that far, it would be your left-hand side on the greed side. Like, the market's gone up. And January, February, and March of 2000, we shattered, just destroyed all the records for putting money into technology funds. Now, we didn't know what was coming. We shattered the previous record just in time to get our heads taken off collectively. And then, if you fast forward a little bit, October of 2002 was the first time we've ever seen 5 months in a row of net outflows, meaning we took more money out of mutual funds than we put in for 5 months in a row. And October of 2002 was the fifth month in a row, and October of 2002 was also the what? Right, market low. And so just at the time that we should at least be a little cautious, we were pouring money in, and just at the time that maybe we should be a little excited, and if you take Warren Buffett's advice, you should be fearful when everyone else is greedy, and greedy when everyone else is fearful. But we do the opposite. And then, of course, we all became real estate investors in 2006, 2007. And now maybe gold, you know, I don't know, and nobody get mad at me for saying gold, but you know, I don't know what it is, but we have this natural human tendency to repeat that until broke.
How do we then not repeat this so that we don't go broke?
Yeah, I don't know.
Come on. Yeah, tell me. What's the secret?
No, I mean, I think obviously the key to that is having a plan. I mean, having an investment strategy that doesn't depend on making changes based on the market. Because if we rely on changes in the market, we'll always do the wrong thing at the wrong time. I mean, it's just natural to want less of those things that are causing you pain and more of those things that are giving you pleasure or security.
Next, we have a series of three drawings that I wanted to have Carl address. Why don't we go through then the other two here and describe what we're looking at for our radio audience.
Yeah, for the radio audience. Of course, the radio audience.
Yes.
So it's not a Venn diagram. That's the other thing I have to point out. If you're from the Venn diagram police, I know some of these aren't Venn diagrams. I get like long emails explaining why they're not Venn diagrams. They're circle sketches. So let's just get that all clear. It's okay. They're not. So the one circle in the circle sketch says a blog post, article, or book, and the other circle says your life savings, and the overlap says proceed with caution. Another circle sketch, otherwise known in some circles as Venn diagrams, taking a stranger's medicine, the other circle says following random financial advice, and the overlap says could kill you. Both of them could kill you. And then the last one says herd of sheep with economist readers. The overlap was would follow each other off a cliff.
So I think that all three of these speak to our insecurities when it comes to our own financial lives and how we tend to turn everywhere to find an answer instead of relying on ourselves to do some research, to get smart about it.
And I think it makes sense why we do this. I mean, why we look for help. It's this idea, like it's a complex world out there, and it seems to be getting more complex, and a lot of our traditional sort of safety nets are going away. We're taking on more responsibility. So it makes sense that we would look for somebody that could tell us,
right,
hey, what's, you know, is it going to rain? Are my crops going to grow? Like, we've been doing this for a long time.
All right, so describe what we're looking at here.
So this is another circle sketch, and it says, now this was based, I'll give you a little history quickly, this was based on a book called The Secret. And if we have any secret lovers here, just please save your, we can talk later when I have security around. So there's a circle that says buying things we can't afford. There's another circle that says believing the, and in quotes, universe will pay for it. And the overlap says ends up in collections. And I don't know why you chose, Tess chose these tonight, so I don't know why you chose, I have plenty to say about it, but.
Well, I wonder why we think the universe will solve our money problems when it doesn't solve any of our other problems.
You know, this one's really fun for me to point, easy for me to poke fun at, but it's a slippery slope. Yeah, I'm thinking in sort of maybe the business world, right? We've heard the idea of like fake it till you make it.
Right.
Right, and I had an example of this of somebody I knew. And he was a neighbor, and he was a real estate agent. Business wasn't going particularly well. So he thought getting a Bentley would help business. So he got a Bentley, right? And it was this idea that if I say I send it out to the to the universe, it will come back. But there's some fake it till you make it, have confidence. Like there's something good there, something. And then there's this line to like, that's really stupid. And I don't know where that line can get fuzzy sometimes.
This one, I think, really just sums it up. And it is the final drawing in Carl's book. And I think it gets to why your art resonates with so many people, which is, it's the simplicity. And that message is so attractive because it's something that we can do. Right? So tell us what we're looking at on the screen.
So another circle sketch, one circle says slow and it's underlined, and the other circle says steady and it's underlined, and the overlap is longer than I do now. This is one of the first sketches I ever did. It says, end up with more money than your brother-in-law. And I have to mention, I don't have a brother-in-law that does this, but it's like the metaphorical brother. Like, he's always the bad guy, right? I mean, he always lies at the barbecue about how he picked the best stock and you didn't. My brother-in-laws don't do this. So it's just a clarification. End up with more money than your brother-in-law that's always chasing the next Google, which we could replace now with the next Apple. And the reality is, that's exciting, but it doesn't really end. I mean, it's entertainment. And I think going to the movies is cheaper and more entertaining than always trying to find the next Google. And this slow and steady thing is totally, it's boring. And I knew, you know, we have a problem when CNBC is on in your dentist office, right? Like, it's become sort of America's favorite spectator sport. It's not meant to be that way. It's not meant to be that way. That's, you know, circus clowns are entertaining too. CNBC, we won't go too far with that. But so being slow and steady, boring, short-term boring, long-term exciting.
I just want to close with telling people that at one point when we had you on the show, we kind of put you on the spot and asked you to come up with a drawing right then and there for us. And you came up with this wonderful, talk to us about the elephant and the dime.
So the question was, I can't remember what you had asked me about.
I don't think I asked.
You asked me about something like, why do we keep buying things? Like, it was like going to Costco and buying crates and crates of things, right? And so luckily I had had this experience with another family member who, my mother-in-law, she loves to buy chocolate. And she was at Whole Foods and chocolate was on sale. And so she brought me like a case of chocolate, like a bag full of chocolate. And I told her, you know, and I think this is an old saying. I mean, this certainly isn't something I'd heard this somewhere. But an elephant for a dime is only a good deal if you need an elephant and you have a dime. So I think that is it, unless we want to skip into other ones.
Yeah, I think that'll do it.
Thank you very much.
Carl Richards and I talking in Park City, Utah last week. If you'd like to see some of the drawings that we talked about, we've got a slideshow at marketplace.org/money. What must it be like to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? 43 presidents and their families do know that feeling. George Washington oversaw construction of the White House but never lived in it. Being the president affords all manner of luxuries, of course. I mean, you have your own airplane, right? And you don't pay rent. But as we head into Super Tuesday amid a heated campaign season, you might be surprised to learn that the presidential lifestyle does not come cheap. And even a $400,000 salary does not go far in defraying costs. Jody Cantor's new book, The Obamas, highlights some of the expenses involved in being first family. We met up a couple of weeks ago to talk about that at Cantor's workplace in New York City, where she covers politics for the nation's paper of record. Jody Cantor, thanks for hosting us here at the New York Times.
Welcome to the paper.
This book gives us a real glimpse into the daily life of the first family. And at several points in the book, you do talk about the kinds of money issues that come up for the president and his wife. And I guess what might surprise some people is that they actually don't completely live on the taxpayer dime. There are things that they have to pay for.
Not only are there things that they have to pay for, but those things are really expensive. You know, the whole point of my reporting in this book is to really take us behind the scenes in the White House and show us what happens when two pretty regular Chicagoans, very talented and ambitious, but regular people become president and first lady. And there are all sorts of surprises, some good and some bad. And one thing is that there are very complicated rules governing who pays for what in the White House. The Obamas have to pay for a lot of stuff themselves, and the prices are at Ritz-Carlton levels.
Do you have any idea of what that means for them, you know, kind of based on what their financial situation is?
Aides and advisors, you know, they weren't willing to give me the exact numbers, but they do say that the Obamas are concerned about money and watch it carefully, in part because remember that they can't do anything on a small scale, normal level. Like when they go to Hawaii for a beach vacation, the truth is they can't rent a house that's $1,500 a week. It's just not going to work for the Secret Service. It's not going to work for the whole setup. They end up renting these, you know, extremely luxurious places that have a lot of property around them because that's what makes it them easier to protect. Of course, the government is not going to pay for that vacation rental. There would be a political scandal. So they're accumulating these expenses very fast. I mean, nobody in the White House said that these people are destitute. Obviously, they're wealthy Americans, but money is a concern. And people did mention that the Obamas are really banking on writing their memoirs and getting big book advances in the future to help cover the costs.
In the chapter called This Is Not My Beautiful Home, you outline a little bit of what the first family has to pay when it comes to entertaining. And as we know, that's part of the job, right? So they don't pay to live there, but they do have to pay for things like their food, parties that are not official gatherings. What kind of money does all that require? And how does that affect the family budget?
Well, people say that there is kind of a ritual with every new president and first lady. They get to the White House, they move in, they start to live there. A month or so in, they get their first bill, and there is a moment of shock. And remember that at the White House, you can't just order, you know, a bunch of pizzas and have people over. You've got butlers, you've got ushers, you've got housekeepers, and their salaries are factored into the cost, which is part of why it's so expensive.
Then can you give us a sense of what portion of that they have to pay for? I mean, if they have a Super Bowl party, which there's a great photo in your book of one of those. Is all of that footed by the Obamas?
It depends on what kind of event it is. If the president is watching the Super Bowl and invites a whole bunch of friends over, it is definitely personal entertaining. And that's really why the bills accumulate so much, because the Obamas can't go out as much as regular people do. You know, they can, say, go to Attorney General Eric Holder's house to watch the Super Bowl, but it requires some advance preparation. When you're the president and first lady, you end up staying in and hosting people yourself. There are a lot of other new expenses along the way. I'll give you a tiny example. If the Obamas want to bring an extra person on Air Force One, they have to reimburse the government the equivalent of first-class airfare. Now, on the one hand, you could say that a ride on Air Force One for first-class airfare is a pretty good deal. But on the other hand, well, okay, that means that they can, A, only bring friends who can afford first-class airfare on Air Force One, or they have to pay for it themselves, which can get expensive very quickly.
That really makes you wonder if and how you could ever have a truly middle-class president.
It really does. I mean, the famous example is the Clintons, you know, who, you know, had serious issues with legal bills in the White House. And you know, there are also ways in which being wealthy can be an enormous advantage in the presidency. And the chief one is having a vacation home to escape to, which the Obamas don't have. The Obamas tried to go back to their home in Chicago very early in the presidency, 3 weeks in, and it didn't go that well. They live in Chicago. It's an urban environment. It's hard to protect. They were disrupting traffic. The Secret Service dropped these kind of black curtains down both sides of their home, so they couldn't even see out. Contrast that with the Bushes, who had their ranch in Crawford that they built during the presidential campaign, almost as if they knew they were going to need a place to escape to. So the Obamas are sometimes criticized for renting a nice house in Hawaii, but they don't have another escape where they can retreat all of the time. They have Camp David, of course. The First Lady likes Camp David quite a bit. The president, according to friends, finds it a little bit artificial.
Jody Kantor, author of The Obamas, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Coming up, what it's like to try and save as a member of the middle class.
When our second son was born, I left my job and we had to cash out our retirement, so we have none. We basically live paycheck to paycheck. We have minimal savings, but we feel like our situation will improve.
More stories of wealth and poverty on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. It's everyone's favorite old saw, the light bulb joke. For example, how many folk singers does it take to change a light bulb? Well, two, of course. One to change the bulb, and one to write a song about how good the old light bulb was. And you know what? Some people are indeed mourning old light bulbs as new government guidelines take incandescent bulbs off the shelves. We've all learned about compact fluorescence by now, and LEDs are on the rise, but riddle me this. How many reporters does it take to enlighten you about changes in the light bulb market? Well, hopefully just one. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Eve Trobe.
Make no mistake, they are among you, the light bulb hoarders. They're often aesthetes, very picky about light.
I get really aggravated by bad lighting, and it just makes me feel super unsettled if I don't have warm, bright lighting.
That's Katie Modell. She's felt nervous since the summer when she first learned the U.S. is phasing out incandescents. The reason? George W. Bush signed a law 5 years ago to kill off inefficient bulbs. But so far, Modell hates the alternatives, so she's stocking up on the old kind.
I'm already just trying to get as many as I can. So, yeah. In all other ways, I do try to be energy efficient, but lighting, I'm just like, I can't.
U.S. companies had to stop making 100-watt incandescent bulbs this year. They're the least efficient, burning 90 of those 100 watts of electricity as heat, not light. Next year, the 75 watters go away. And in 2014, no more 40 or 60 watt bulbs will be made. The law only covers the manufacturing side. There's no telling when the supply of incandescents will actually run out. Celia Coopers-Midlerman at Consumers Union says many shoppers remain suspicious of more efficient alternatives.
We all still go into fitting rooms and bathrooms and other places where the lighting is not very flattering. And I think people feel that, you know, they're going to have to take that home with them now.
She says if you tried compact fluorescents, those curlicue bulbs a few years ago, and found them too harsh, buy some new ones. They're much better now. You can put those early CFLs somewhere where you won't use them much, like the garage. And LED bulbs are getting better and cheaper all the time. But Learman says it's not just the quality that bugs people about all the new choices.
Buying a light bulb has been one of those areas where you really didn't have to know much. It was sort of, you picked up a bulb and they were pretty much all the same. Now, you're going to have to learn some new lingo.
Okay, but don't run for your notebook. It's only two terms, which I bet you can remember just by hearing them. Instead of watts, now you buy based on lumens. Like illuminate, lumens.
Instead of watts, you really want to look for lumens. Lumens is what tells you how bright the bulb is. The more lumens, the brighter the bulb.
But there's also the color of light each bulb gives off, in kelvins.
How warm or cool the light looks, and that's the color temperature, which is put in kelvins.
You might remember Kelvin from high school chemistry. Yes, same dead British scientist. Now, to test this knowledge in the field.
We're currently in aisle one, which is our light bulb aisle. I met Home Depot supervisor Dave Hauer at the Burbank, California store. The light bulb selection spans 100 feet, from floodlights to some strange purple curlicues.
You have EcoBulb party bulbs?
EcoBulb party bulbs, that's correct, for those people who want to go all night and save energy doing it.
The store still carries incandescents. Bulbs over 100 watts and under 40 are not affected by the new law. And there are halogens, efficient enough to pass muster. But people still grumble about selection.
Now, the biggest complaint that we get is cost. Your standard incandescent is, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to an LED, which is more expensive.
25 times more expensive. But it also lasts years, nay, decades longer than one of those old cheap incandescents. To help explain the difference in cost over time, every new bulb must now have a lighting facts label. It looks a lot like the food nutrition facts label, but with information like brightness, cost per year, and bulb lifespan. Dan Thompson joined me at the store as well. He's with the Building Doctors.
We do comprehensive energy audits on homes to see how people are using and wasting energy.
Yes, he wears medical scrubs to do that. Thompson says just changing your bulbs can put a big dent in the utility bills.
Anywhere from 10 to 20%.
But he says new bulbs don't always work as planned. Put a compact fluorescent in a fixture you constantly flick on and off, it burns out faster. Dimmer switches and three-way fixtures also pose problems. I ask him about my own dining room light, an old six-armed thing with small bulbs, the kind that look like a candle flame.
They do make LED bulbs. We just saw
them. There's one right here.
LED,
yeah.
With the small base. It's just, I don't think the light's there yet, in my opinion.
Too piercing, he says, not soft. So, just stick with old school bulbs for the dining room? They're 25-watt incandescents, not affected by the new law.
The few times that you have that lit up, I'm okay with it.
One less decision to make in the light bulb aisle? I just might be glowing. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The big news coming out of Utah this week, after my onstage turn with Carl Richards, of course, has to do with extreme family planning. A Provo woman gave birth to her third leap day baby on Wednesday. Her other two sons were born on leap days in 2004 and 2008. That is a record, by the way. Now, all of us have been kids, and some of us have them, so we know that they are expensive. So, if you're thinking about adding to your family, you might want to pin your ears back. Carmen Wong Ulrich is back with us. She is the author of The Real Cost of Living. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Tess. Thanks for having me.
So, having a kid, this is one big financial decision, isn't it? I mean, this may sound a little strange, but, you know, how does this compare to planning for any other major expense in your life, maybe a car or a house? Not that I'm comparing children to cars and homes.
I was going to say, let me preface this before the hate mail to me comes in. Listen, I have a daughter myself. You can't, of course, make all of these kind of personal decisions solely based on finances.
Of course not.
But if you have the luxury of having a choice as to when you can have a child and when you can plan for especially additional children, a second child or a third or such, yes, I mean, it's really great to think it through financially, if only so that everyone is prepared in the family to handle the additional cost and expense, as well as all the extra work, of course, and love and affection and attention.
Of course, of course. So you get your notepad out and you're trying to figure out how much this is going to cost. Where on earth do you begin?
Begin with pregnancy, because this is the point where the costs start adding up in terms of what you need to think about. Think about how much time are you planning on taking off and how is that time off going to be paid for? If you work for an employer that gives you a certain amount of weeks off, that's wonderful. But what if you need more? And if and when you're going back to work and it's several months out, but you think about, okay, in what capacity am I going back? Full time, part time? If cutting the hours down is going to cut down the pay, those are things to think about. And also, even, you know, while you're pregnant, thinking about the childcare costs. If this is a second or a third child, the childcare costs may be very different than if it's the first. The first is always the biggest shock.
Mm. Right.
So you want to really take all those things into consideration and look at your monthly budget and where that money is going to come from.
What about some of the indirect costs? I mean, your grocery bill is going to go up. Is your house big enough?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to especially the third child, many folks have to make that move. So that's something you absolutely have to take into consideration. Now, the nitty gritty, the monthly nitty gritty of it, everything from who's in diapers, how many of them are in diapers, and in terms of the grocery bill, a child who's a year old or a year and a half old has very different eating and grocery habits than a child who's six.
Right.
So you're really going to have to take into account that, you know, maybe you have an eight-year-old and a six-year-old who you can buy the same food that you eat. But then when you have a baby, then you're going to have to buy a whole nother slew of types of groceries. So you're going to see your bill expand and contract depending on the age differences in between the children. And, you know, of course, if you have a boy... An older boy.
Going to be eating you out of house and home.
Who's going to eat you out of the house and home, and how many boys do you have?
Right. So you've got all this down, and once again with a caveat that financial considerations are not the only ones at play when you're having a child. Mm-hmm. It's all about emotions and expanding your family. But how do you know whether you are financially ready for a baby?
Make a real assessment where you look at your monthly finances, look at where you're living. That's the number one thing, because we know that the number one expense pretty much that most of us all have is housing. So that's the biggest part of your budget. Can you stay? If you need to move, how much more, you know, can you get? Would you have to move someplace else? So that's always the first question I think people should really think about. It's the biggest expense. Or can you even reduce, you know, the cost of where you're living by moving someplace so that you can afford the child? You got to think of everything from the transportation, who's around. Do you have family that are available to you to help? And if not, financially, you're going to have to quasi buy that family to help you out. What are those costs going to be? I really recommend, and this is something I did, is do a lot of research in your community. I went to a lot of local neighborhood message boards with moms asking some questions. You know, what's the going rate for full-time childcare? What's a great daycare and how much does that cost? Visit these establishments. Talk with moms in your neighborhood. You know, because as much as we can do and sit behind the computer, I think it's really valuable to speak to women who are living it now before you end up in that space. And also think about, too, is it time for you to step out of the workplace for a while? And if you can and you want to, can you downsize your life to live off of that one paycheck?
Hmm.
Don't forget, when and if you do go back to work, there's that thing, which I really find this not the nicest term, but maternity penalty,
right,
which means that you're going to be behind where other people were who stayed in. So you're not going to make as much money. Can you plan for that a little bit? And when are you going to go back and in what capacity?
Carmen Wong-Ulrich is the author of The Real Cost of Living, a good friend of the show. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
The connotation of middle class has changed a lot.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
As part of our wealth and poverty coverage all this week on Marketplace, we introduced you to people from across the class spectrum and around the country. Today, we're focusing on two big issues, budgeting and saving. So allow me to introduce you to Daryl Snell, a 43-year-old waiter in Nashville who makes $21,000 a year. Courtney Kinsey, a 29-year-old mom and freelance writer in Des Moines, Iowa. She and her husband live on about $48,000 a year. And Rob Winninger, 51. He and his wife own a small business here in Los Angeles, and they make about $130,000 a year.
My name is Daryl Snell. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and I live alone. I don't keep a strict budget, but always in the back of my mind is the thought that, okay, the mortgage is going to be this part, and it's been cold, so the electric bill is going to be a little higher, and the gas bill is going to be a little higher, so maybe I shouldn't spend as much. I don't have it written down, but it's always in the back of my mind that I have to be aware of what I'm spending and how I'm spending, and to be as frugal as possible, I clip coupons. I buy in bulk and freeze things. I have a huge pantry. That's how you make it. You pay as little as you have to get as much as you can and then make it last. I have absolutely no savings. I think there might be $50 in my savings account. I worry about retirement as much as I worry about my day-to-day living. It's not going to happen. I'm going to work until the day I die.
My name's Courtney Kimsey. I live in Des Moines, Iowa. My husband Keith and I have two boys who are 5 and almost 2. We try to maintain a budget, but because I do freelance in my work, I cannot guarantee anything. It's hard. It's a struggle, and we've worked on it for years. The money that we do have, is we can't let any of it go. My car is literally 19 years old. We basically live paycheck to paycheck. We have minimal savings, but to lose his income, my husband's, we'd be fearful of losing our house. When our second son was born, I left my job because of daycare issues, and we had to cash out our retirement, so we have none. I feel like a downer when I'm talking about some of this, but even though we do have a struggle, we feel like our situation will improve. When our youngest son can go to school, then I'll go back to work full-time, and having two salaries in our family will make an immense difference.
My name is Rob Wininger. I live in Sherman Oaks, California. I'm married to Sandra Wininger. We have 4 children together in private schools. And that's something that's been a huge, huge aspect of, you know, our budget. I think we are one of those families that really keeps Costco in business. You know, we're playing it day by day rather than having some sense of security behind us financially. We have maybe $8,000, $10,000 in the savings account that would be for emergencies. But we don't have any investment accounts for retirement. I've heard people call it, you know, FU money, which is that sack in the bank that you know you're okay. For me to know I have an extra $100,000 in the bank and I don't have to worry as much, that is something I'm a little bit envious of.
. 66% of Americans told a recent survey that they have adequate emergency savings. That figure from the Employee Benefits Research Institute and the Consumer Federation of America seems applause-worthy, until you find out it is down from about 71% in 2010. So when we find someone with great savings habits, we like to acknowledge them. And one of the folks we spoke with for the Wealth and Poverty coverage fits that bill, which brings us to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award.
I'm Jacqueline Byers. I live in Kansas City, Missouri, and I am currently employed with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City. I'm in between $40,000 to $45,000 a year, and for what I do, that's comfortable for me. I don't necessarily have a budget. What I do is keep track of all my spending, and I watch how much I spend in certain areas. When I see I'm kind of going a little overboard, then I'll pull back. But as far as a budget, what I've learned to do is just keep track of every dollar that I spend. I have a spreadsheet that shows me where each dollar was spent. I do have my emergency fund built up thanks to a class that I'm going through. I've really been mindful of putting that emergency fund money away. I've got my bills and my home and car lined up to where it's all taken care of, and what's extra goes to the travel account. So that's my splurge money. That's my mad money. Travel. Travel and see the world.
Wow, Jacqueline, a spreadsheet, an emergency fund? Bravo. We've popped a prize piggy in the post for you. Hopefully our little blue plastic friend can help you save up for a trip around the world. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, no credit, no service.
The bank was telling me, great job on paying off your debt, but, you know, you need to get back in debt, so to speak, in order for us to help you.
What? The crime and punishment of living life without credit. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Sasha Woodruff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week. This is APM, American Public Media.